From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, reviews of President Trump's speech to Congress from both sides of the aisle.
The tone last night was precisely what it needed to be.
The notion that he was given sort of good grades for the fact that he didn't go off script and say something insulting to somebody is a pretty low standard.
Mexico's consul in Detroit working to calm immigrants' fears.
And the most important thing is I can tell you, I'm sure that most of the Mexican immigrants that live here in Michigan are not criminals. So that's why I'm saying they don't have to be afraid.
Starry stonewort, the invasive algae attacking our lakes and winning.
It was stretching in a dense mat so thick that not even the smallest of fish could swim through it.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is putting together a proposal to hopefully improve our schools following a new federal law and a decade-long drop in quality. Later in the hour, we'll ask, what's the best way to measure quality and success in our schools? But first, President Trump's first speech before a joint session of Congress last night delivered themes and promises that are very familiar.
For too long, we've watched our middle class shrink as we've exported our jobs and wealth to foreign countries. We've financed and built one global project after another, but ignored the fates of our children in the inner cities of Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, and so many other places throughout our land.
And delivered in a tone viewed as more presidential, more aspirational.
We are one people with one destiny. We all bleed the same blood. We all salute the same great American flag. And we all are made by the same God.
Let's see how the president's speech was received on both sides of the aisle. We begin by welcoming Congressman Paul Mitchell, the Republican representative from Michigan's 10th District. Congressman, how would you characterize the president's speech?
It captured the aspirations of Americans. It captured the expectations that they have of the president and Congress to get things done. And I think a great job of outlining the agenda over the next 6 to 9 months, which is to repeal Obamacare, to restore health care in America, to address our tax system, which is truly a nightmare, and to have a tax reform for all Americans, and to get at our infrastructure, which is obviously a significant issue in Michigan and across this nation, to start to fix our infrastructure and have a program to do that and not have it be haphazard. We made great gains in terms of outlining that direction, and I think we're moving forward.
In talking about health care and repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, the phrase the president used last night, and one we're hearing more and more from Republicans, is the phrase access to coverage. That word access, it can mean several things. What does it mean to you?
Well, I think we have to recognize there's a difference between having health insurance and being able to access health care. Deductibles and copay costs have just gone through the roof. So you may have health insurance and you face the dilemma, can I use the health insurance? Can I afford to go to the doctor or have a procedure? Can I afford my prescriptions? So the reality is we have to address the fundamental concern, which is what it costs for people to get access to actually secure health care. The plan that's in place, I think bills will be unveiled next week to begin that process further. We'll start to address those issues so that, in fact, the objective is to have health care for all Americans they can access and be healthy.
Infrastructure. The president called for a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure. What do you think that might come at the expense of? Like, how do we pay for that?
Well, first, I think President Trump is a private business guy. You're well aware of that. I come from the private business world. Step one of addressing how you spend money is, are you spending the money you have right now efficiently and effectively? I believe we're going to see budget cuts in federal agencies. You saw the freeze on non-essential personnel. We're going to reduce the number of people sitting in cubicles that is questionable how much productivity we get out of them, and it can't be possible to measure. I think the first expectation is, how much money are we spending that we really aren't getting much return on it? I advocated zero-based budgeting. Now, something the size of the federal government, that can be hard to do for every agency every year, but if you did it on a rotating basis every 2 to 3 years, you could start to address how money's truly being spent. And to be honest, it's massive.
Congressman, I want to turn to the president's tone and message about immigration and what
sure.
we heard last night.
Sure.
There are immigrants who are here illegally, who commit crimes, yes. But the vast majority of people who are here without documents are like you and like me. They're working hard and they're trying to make a better life for themselves and their families. How do you distinguish between the ones our president calls the bad hombres and the rest of these hardworking people?
Well, I think the president talked about that last night in admittedly broad terms, and I think that's the role of the president, especially when you're talking about to the United States people and what he expects from Congress. We first have to address securing our borders. Failure to do that, you're not a nation if you don't have borders. He also talked last night about immigration reform and having the courage to stand up and talk about our immigration system, which is as outmoded as you could possibly expect. The reality is this country should use a merit-based or a skill-based system for immigration in this country and not what we've used for, 50 or 60 years? I have to go back and look the last time any major revisions made in that. That would again address the issue of we train huge numbers of people in this country, engineers, other things, and when they can't stay here, if they want to, they've got to go back home. We pay to train them, and our college universities, there's taxpayer money goes into that. We tell them they can't stay here. They can contribute to our economy. They can build businesses here. Our system set up poorly. We need to start doing that, and I believe the president is intent on moving forward with that.
Congressman, last night Mr. Trump said that his job is not to represent the world. It's to represent the American people. Is this not a retreat from the long-held view that the president is the leader of the free world?
The president is the leader of the United States, and the United States is the leader of the free world. But the first thing you have to do is you have to lead your country. You have to put your country first. You have to put your citizens and your voters first. That ought to be the role of the president. It certainly is also my role in terms of my role in Congress. The first concern needs to be what is in the best interest of our country, our citizens, our economy. That's question one. And beyond that is, to some extent, offer guidance and leadership for the rest of the world, and any given thing, try to do no harm in the process. But we had that, in my opinion, very distorted over the last 8 years. And frankly, we talked about being leader of the free world, and we didn't even do that well.
Mr. Trump's tone during the speech last night, many are saying very different from the inauguration speech and his acceptance speech at the convention. To what do you attribute that change in tone?
Well, I think there's a change. There's a change when you're campaigning and when you actually begin the process of governing. But I think the tone last night was precisely what it needed to be. We need to come together and do the right thing for this country. And I agree with him entirely on the partisanship being destructive. We spend a whole lot of time sometimes dealing with messaging votes, and we don't get as much done as we could. Let's message less, do more.
Republican Congressman Paul Mitchell, thank you so much for taking our questions, Congressman.
Good to talk to you.
For the Democratic reaction to last night's speech, we welcome Congressman Dan Kildee, the Democratic representative from the 5th District in Flint. Congressman, what did you take away from the president's speech?
Well, I think the reviews that his tone was better than what we've heard are honest. He didn't call anybody a name. He didn't use pejorative language about any population. But there was really no substance to the policy proposals that he laid out. They were all very broad stroke, and I think he has a math problem. He wants to invest $1 trillion in infrastructure. I'm with him on that. But he wants to do it and also increase defense spending by an enormous sum, cut taxes, cut our domestic agenda. I don't know how he does it. It seems as though, as president, he is yet to embrace the fact that he has to make hard choices, not just say things that he thinks people want to hear. We're going to have to see some more substance before we can really judge how this presidency will go. But so far, I'm not impressed.
Did he say anything last night that you could get behind?
This notion of spending on infrastructure is something that many of us have been proposing for a very long time. The problem is this. We have a specific proposal that we've been working on. He just says, I'm going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. He should bring a plan to Congress. There are a lot of things that he said that I disagree with. I'm very concerned about sort of continued generalization about immigration, about immigrants and what they mean to our society, this idea of privatizing funding for public education, including using public dollars to fund religious schools. There was a lot to disagree with, but on those areas where I agree, I'm looking for something more substantive, something that I can actually point to and say, yeah, let's do this. So far, he's just sending get-well cards to our infrastructure when we really need real investment.
There was no mention of Flint water last night. What would you be looking for him to say?
Well, I think he should accept the responsibility that as president, he has to take care of these crises. President Obama stepped up. Now Donald Trump's the president. I would have preferred to hear him mention Flint, that he's going to finish the work that President Obama started. My guest was Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha for the address last night, hoping to sort of make that point. But alas, there was no mention of Flint.
The president said last night, everything that is broken in our country can be fixed. So why not join forces, Democrats and Republicans, to unite for the good of our country and the people? And that got me wondering, have you or any of your Democratic colleagues been invited to the table by the White House?
No, we have not. I have reached out to the White House specifically on issues related to Flint and infrastructure, and so far, no response.
We have seen presidents in the past, both Democratic and Republican presidents, and the American people, long considering our president to be the leader of the free world. Congressman, last night we heard the president say to us, his job is not to represent the world, it's to represent the American people. Is this not a retreat from America's world leadership role?
I think it's a dangerous signal that that could be the direction he wants to take. And the unfortunate thing is that, you know, in order to, I think, pander to some voices, Donald Trump oversimplifies so many things. The truth of the matter is the role of the United States and the role of the President of the United States is complex. He has to be able to be a leader for our country and has a principal responsibility to lead this nation. But it's impossible to ignore the fact that our national interests are very much aligned with our place on the globe. And you can't make that sort of distinction without raising the question as to what this means. We have a responsibility to the world, to ourselves, to be a beacon of hope and light, and to be an agent for change that's positive. It's in our national interest to do so, but we also have a moral calling to do that. And it's very concerning to hear a president articulate a withdrawal from the use of the U.S.'s moral authority in the world. That's not smart, it's not in our interest, and it's not consistent with the values of the people of this country.
Congressman Dan Kildee, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Starry Stonewort kind of sounds like some comic book hero, but Starry Stonewort is no hero. It's the villain, an invasive weed infesting waters from Michigan onto Wisconsin and Minnesota. Scott Brown is executive director of the Michigan Lake and Stream Association. He has spent years studying Starry Stonewort, and now he's writing a book on it. Good to have you with us, Scott. What is Starry Stonewort?
Well, Starry Stonewort is one of 300 species that belong to the family Caraceae. Used to be many, many more species, but we've lost them due to environmental degradation over the years. Right now, in Michigan, for example, there's about 15 species of Caraceae, most of them very beneficial to the waters where they're located. But Starry Stonewort is actually considered a macroalgae, and we know it's the closest living relative to land plants going back to the Cretaceous period, about 400 million years ago, back when nature was experimenting with DNA, so to speak. So we know, for example, that the whole genre, actually, they love high-quality waters. They like light. They like a lot of light, which speaks to water transparency. They like a lot of calcium carbonate. And they like soft substrates. And unfortunately, one of the reasons Starry Stonewort has done so well in Michigan waters and in the waters of the Great Lakes is that many of our waters are high quality. They have good water transparency. They're stable. They have stable ecosystems and very high in calcium carbonate.
So it's checking all the boxes.
Yeah, exactly. You're checking all the boxes. So here I come. I've got just a fragment or a little starry bubble enters a lake that has nice clear water, high calcium carbonate, soft substrates, and voila, you've got the recipe for an explosive population of starry stonewort. Kind of interesting, even though it's disappearing in European waters because their water quality isn't what it should be, is not what it once was, because we have so many high-quality lakes, actually within an hour of these studios, we have several hundred lakes that now host starry stonewort. So I guess you could say that southeast Michigan, stretching from Oakland County down into the Irish Hills, has now become the new world capital, so to speak, of starry stonewort.
How do I know if I'm seeing starry stonewort? What's it look like when it's in our waters?
Well, it's an unusual-looking species. It's kind of a crude plant-like-looking structure, and it's a series of nodes that contain a whorl of 5 to 7 branchlets, and there's a series of them. So in European waters, the length of the plant can range anywhere from 18 inches to 2 meters here in Michigan waters because conditions are so ideal.
Is it making like a big mat that lies
on
the surface?
That's exactly right. The first time I saw it in 2007, it was stretching in a dense mat from waters of maybe 8 inches in depth to waters of 16 feet in depth, and so thick that not even the smallest of fish could swim through it. And that's part of the problem. It forms these dense meadows in mid to late spring. The fish can't access their spawning grounds. It prevents fish from foraging on aquatic insects and other little fish. So it really has a disruptive effect on our inland lake ecosystems.
And it, aesthetically, it's ugly. If you're looking at the waters and it's covered with this mat of...
Well, actually, I don't know if I'd use the term ugly. It's quite... If you look at the plant in and of itself...
But if you're walking along...
It's actually quite beautiful. It's quite beautiful in a crude sort of way.
But and when you're walking by the waterway and
it's a bright green, dense meadow that, again, it can, depending on the depth of the water, the meadows can range anywhere from inches in thickness up to 2 meters in thickness or a little over 6 feet.
Where did it come from? When and how did it get to Michigan?
Well, it's native to Europe. There are some populations in Japan. It's been found in China, but primarily Northern Europe. And what we think happened is that given all the transoceanic freighters that come across the North Atlantic, it entered the St. Lawrence Seaway. It was found in the St. Lawrence Seaway in 78. By 83, staff members from the Great Lakes fisheries right here in Ann Arbor discovered it in the Detroit River off Belle Isle. And in 2006, it was found in an inland lake by Flint. And since then, it's now spread to several hundred inland lakes here in Michigan. Michigan is known to have the largest population now of starry stonewort anywhere in the world.
And what can we do about it?
Well, the lake management folks are out there working with different chemical suites. It's a very persistent species that's very resistant to many of the aquatic herbicides that they've tried so far. They can get it to fold back or to slow down its growth a bit for a few months, and then it bounces right back. But to prevent it, the best thing people can do is when they're out fishing and using these lakes is to make sure that they're not transporting it to new lakes. You know, using clean boats, clean waters techniques, clean, drain, dry, to make sure that there aren't fragments or starry boobles attached to their trailer or their boat that then they could subsequently hitchhike on to another lake.
Now, this is one of the older invasive species to plague Michigan. Has the state, has the DNS and DEQ and Agriculture Department come up with better prevention programs for these newer species?
Not really. They promote clean boats, clean waters. The most important message in regards to starry stonewort is that Michigan waters perfectly align, the ecological conditions found in Michigan waters perfectly align with the requirements in most cases for starry stonewort. So if it enters these lakes, it's going to become a problem. It likes the long daylight hours of mid to late spring and early summer where you see literally explosive growth. Within a week, it can take over the shallower areas of an inland lake. It blocks the growth of native aquatic plants, and again, it prevents fish from accessing their spawning grounds. Even though it's beautiful from a natural history standpoint, it's very disruptive to our inland lakes because its growth is not regulated here. There's nothing to limit its growth, so therefore it grows in such abundance that it becomes a problem.
It sounds like it's resilient, and it sounds like it's winning.
It's winning, exactly right, and we don't have any good answers right now. All I would say is this is a wonderful opportunity for grad students out there who are interested in freshwater ecology or aquatic botany to get out there and study. And this species is worthy of several PhD theses as far as I can tell. It's very interesting, got a wonderful natural history, but again, because our waters are so perfect, it's been called the connoisseur of clean waters. Michigan has ideal conditions for the growth of starry stonewort.
Scott Brown, Executive Director of the Michigan Lake and Stream Association. He has been studying starry stonewort, is writing a book on it, and as you say, it's tough and it seems to be winning.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You think of Michigan, you should think beer. Michigan is fifth in the nation now in the number of breweries, microbreweries, and brew pubs. Here with us now is someone who has really led the way in making Michigan such a leader in the world of beer and brewing. Larry Bell, the founder and CEO of Bell's Brewery. It is great to have you make the trip from Kalamazoo to be with us here today on Stateside.
Well, thanks. Always love a visit to Ann Arbor.
Got to ask, what brought you to brewing in the first place and to Kalamazoo?
I wound up in Kalamazoo to attend Kalamazoo College. And after college, I worked for a small European-style bakery called Zarcozy Bakery, which was yeast and grains. See, my dad was a home winemaker. I was interested in collecting beer cans.
I see things kind of
forming. Jimmy Carter legalized home brewing. And 1980, I moved into a house with some other guys, all like beer, and went out and bought a kit and started brewing in my basement. You know, and then I think it was 82, the Real Ale Company over in Chelsea opened. I kind of spied on them and saw what they were doing. Unfortunately for them, you know, their business was short-lived, but it was good to see what they had done.
And you had all these little seeds kind of planted anyway, so.
Yeah, my home brewing was getting a little out of control. I think the statute of limitations is over, so, you know, I might have been selling some cases out of the basement.
Maybe, sort of.
And there came a time I had a Fisher cut bait, and I got a check for my birthday for $200, and that's what I started the company with. I wrote to the federal government, said, what do I have to do to get a license? Because I got to make this legal.
And that happened in what, 85? You sold your first beer commercially in 85?
Yeah, I opened the homebrew store in 83, and then the brewery opened in 85.
Did I see somewhere that when you began brewing in Kalamazoo, it was the first time that beer had been brewed legally there since the Prohibition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The old Kalamazoo Brewing Company closed under local prohibition in 1915.
That's just mind-boggling when you think of the way Michigan is in 2017. You know, everywhere we go, there is a cool place to discover beer.
I think when I opened, there was probably less than 50 actual brewing companies in the country. And now we are north of 5,000.
That is unbelievable. And it has certainly been my sense, Larry Bell, that in the past decade, and really the last 5 years, Bell's has really emerged as one of Michigan's most recognizable companies. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, we've been around a long time. And when you go back to the early days, there was a point where I'm the only brewery in Michigan. And I'm loading my van on Fridays, and I'm driving to Ann Arbor and selling it over here. I'm driving to Lansing or Traverse City and Petoskey, even across the bridge. And in that way, I kind of became the local brewer to the state. And there's still people that, oh, you remember, you used to deliver in that old lousy van of yours. So there's a lot of old-time relationships that I and Bell's have across the state with people. We've been here a long time. You know, on top of that, I think we make really excellent quality beer.
When you think of particularly West Michigan, we think of the breweries that have emerged as major players nationally. Bell's, Founders comes to mind. Is there something special about West Michigan that makes it particularly hospitable to the beer business?
I think what's happened in Michigan, and I don't really want to toot my own horn here, but it's not just West Michigan. I think for the state, you know, when Bell's opened up, we had certain ideals of the kind of beer we wanted to make, and those were bigger beers and all. And so other people that came along then said, hey, that's what's working, so let's make that style of beer as well. Let's really go for this thing. So, you know, Founders or over here Jolly Pumpkin or Shorts up north, people said, wow, we as Michigan brewers, we really make some great beer, and we got to keep that up. We can't be, you know, sloughing this thing. And so I think what happens then is Michigan gets this great reputation for having big, bold, beautiful beers.
And all boats rise. We get a sense that there's a pretty close-knit community in the Michigan brewing community. A lot of collaboration?
You know, there is. Things are changing.
Okay, how so?
Well, the entire craft beer world is changing. We've seen an incredible influx of large corporations buying up small breweries, private equity people coming in. Things may not be quite as collaborative and groovy as they were even 10 years ago.
Interesting. Yeah, that, and as you say, that injects a whole new kind of feel to it. What about the little, smaller breweries? How much do you maybe talk with them, maybe help them along this path that you have navigated so successfully?
You know, a lot of help that happens will come through. We have a professional organization, the Master Brewers Association. Mm-hmm. So we have quarterly meetings. We do technical talks. And that's a great, great time for people on the technical side of things to get together, learn what's going on, do brewery visits. I mean, there is a lot of camaraderie on that level. You know, that happens for us too with the big guys. I mean, we've had issues where we've called our friends at Miller and said, hey, we got an issue. We don't know. Can you help? We've done some testing for small breweries out.
Yeah.
We'll do that now and then. Hey, do you know what you have? No, not really. Why don't you give me a bottle? I'll take it over to the lab. We'll run it for you.
Okay.
You know, we'll give you a baseline.
What kind of advice might you give, you know, Larry, you've all these decades of success in making this happen, talking to someone right now who is brewing beer in their basement and maybe dreams of growing that into the next Bell's?
Right now, in 2016, we saw a dramatic decrease in the growth rate for craft brewing. And, you know, nothing lasts forever.
Okay.
So it's getting a little bit more crunch time in the marketplace. A lot of the places that are opening are brew pubs or tap rooms, which that seems to be the most popular and successful model right now for people getting into the business. Going into packaging, then you really need to have something special to make yourself stand out in a very crowded field. And at retail, at the restaurant bar level, it's tough to get that space right now.
Boy, I just think of, you know, walking into the grocery store and just what presents you there as you walk up to the options is mind-blowing.
Yeah, and you say, you know, small breweries, but, you know, a brewery like Bell's or Sierra Nevada or New Belgium, you know, we have pretty sophisticated sales teams, marketing teams now. You know, when you're starting out, people invest in the brewery, but they also have to remember to invest in people to be able to get out there and deal with wholesalers and retailers. And you have to kind of know how to play that game and have some resources for that as well.
You know, as a business owner, you're looking ahead over the next, say, 5 or 10 years. What are your biggest concerns?
Well, for me, it's been succession. And I know you introduced me as CEO. That's not actually true. My daughter is now CEO. I retain the title of president, but my daughter, Laura, next generation, is coming up. So for me, that's been a big challenge. The easiest thing to do when you get older and look for an exit strategy is to sell.
Right.
Hardest thing to do is to pass it on to your family. That takes a lot of work. But she's great, and so we've been managing that transition, and I have less reports. As I sit here today with you, I have far fewer people reporting to me, and life is a little bit easier.
A little more. I'm just interested. When you go out on a Saturday night anywhere, what beer do you order? What's your go-to fave beer?
When I go out on a Saturday night, I'm usually out with Mrs. Bell, who doesn't drink beer.
Okay.
So I might not be drinking beer. I might be helping her out with a bottle of wine. Now,
if you're not with Mrs. Bell and it's beer time,
you know,
what's your favorite?
There's a beer that actually has an Ann Arbor connection that we brew seasonally called Quinanon Falls. And the beer came to me in a dream one night when I was staying at the Campus Inn. It was a very vivid dream, and I woke up and drew the label on the Campus Inn notepad next to my bed. And driving home, I called the brewer, said, we're going to make this. And I called the artist I knew up in Grand Rapids area and told her, you're going to paint my dream. And she did. And
is there a Quinanon Falls?
No, it only exists in my imagination.
Okay.
It's sort of the Brigadoon of the Boreal North. The natives knew about this. If you're pure of heart, it'll come to you once, twice in your life. And you spend the day in introspection, examining the spirit world in your own life at Quinanon Falls.
Larry Bell, founder and now president of Bell's Brewery, and seemingly enjoying that new role very, very much. It was great to talk with you. Thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This next story gets a little bit wonky, but it's worth it. It's about kids in Michigan schools. You remember the No Child Left Behind Act? Well, the Every Student Succeeds Act is the latest federal standard for schools. State boards of education all across the country are issuing draft plans on how they'll meet the new requirements. The Michigan Board of Ed wants public input. They'll have to consult with the legislature, then the governor, and then send it all to U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos for review and approval. The Education Trust Midwest has been looking over the plan and put together a policy brief, an assessment of where Michigan's going, and they released it today. Stateside's Lester Graham spoke with Amber Arellano, Executive Director of the Education Trust Midwest.
Start out with telling me about how Every Student Succeeds plan for Michigan works.
This is a really big leadership moment for Michigan and for our state leaders. And if you think about what ESSA is about and what are these, when we talk about improvement plans, it's really about setting out a big vision to say, okay, where do we want to go for our public education system? Everybody agrees about that we want to be a top 10 education state within 15 to 20 years. And so now the question is, like, how do we get there? You know, how are we going to measure that? How are we going to define what school quality looks like? How do we know if we're reaching the goal or not? What are the metrics behind it? And so this plan is all about those systems that underlie that larger goal.
Your brief starts out by reminding us that in a little more than a decade, Michigan's gone from being a fairly average state among education, and now it's among the nation's bottom 10 states in critical measures for student living. It calls that a devastating fall. How did that happen?
That's a great question. And the truth is that no amount of research is going to definitively, conclusively tell us why that happened. The data just tells us where we're at compared to other states. I think there's sort of a broad agreement that there are lots of things that aren't going right. When we look at the best practices of leading education states like Massachusetts and we look at our system, there's a lot that we're not doing.
Such as,
we were almost 20 years behind Massachusetts in raising performance standards for teaching and learning. While Massachusetts made sure that its teachers were being supported and being trained to teach at this new higher level and really preparing kids for a new global economy instead of the old manufacturing jobs of the past, we have not done that. We've done a really poor job at supporting teachers in our state. Things like making sure that low-income students and high-poverty communities are being much, much better funded. We're now in the bottom 10 states in the country for having among the most inequitable funding formulas in the nation. So there's a lot of different sort of structural challenges that we're facing, and solving those problems all start with leadership.
So that problem you were talking about, underperformance at high-poverty schools, what does this plan do to fix that?
Well, what this does is that it basically develops the kind of the underlying systemic improvement plans, right, for things like interventions and supports for low-performing schools, for setting the content standards for teaching and learning in classrooms. Big deal for teachers. As a former teacher, I can tell you that's really important to know. Where am I going as a teacher? How do I define success as a teacher? Things like what the new assessment system looks like, right? So what, you know, I think about it as similar to when I joined Weight Watchers last year and I set a goal for losing weight. And one of the things that you have to do in a program like that is you go every week and you get on a scale and you see if you're reaching your goal or not. And that kind of system essentially sets you up for more support and more accountability for yourself because you need it. So these kinds of systems are similar to that. They're saying, here's how we're doing against those goals. Here's how we're doing if we're continuing to benchmark against other states. Here's what we need to do in terms of our performance, in terms of catching up with the rest of the country. But all of this is really dependent on making sure that the data is actually honest and aligned with those national benchmarks. And part of what the Michigan Department of Education has been discussing is moving away from a system that is aligned with those national benchmarks. And if they do, it'd be a little bit like when we don't like the scale, throwing out the scale and saying, I'd actually like a scale that tells me that I'm thinner than I really am.
So the schools will look like they're performing better, but they still won't be keeping pace with states like Massachusetts.
That's right. So there's the risk in all of that.
Why change that then? Why not just keep what we have to make sure that we can measure from year to year to year how schools are doing?
There's a lot of ideological theories, right, that, as you know, in American politics today, and in Lansing's no different from other states, and that there's a theory out there that, like, somehow that raising performance standards wouldn't be good, or asking more of schools, right, that we should just leave it up to every classroom to sort of figure it out. And, you know, we used to do that 100 years ago, but we stopped doing that. And states like Massachusetts stopped doing that decades ago because they said, you know, we used to have schools that prepared our citizens to work in factories and to not have, you know, strong analytical skills and strong communication skills, and not to be college and career ready, right? Like, so that they can succeed in a post-secondary training program or they can go to college, right? So today's really different. You know, a lot of parents do want their kids to go to college. They need to know, like, how is my kid going to do on the SAT or the ACT? Those are the things that are now the benchmarks in a much more globally competitive economy.
You talked about underperforming schools, especially high poverty schools, but right now we're looking at closing 36 schools, possibly, because they're underperforming. And I keep thinking, okay, if they closed all those schools, next year they're going to have another set of 5% low-performing schools. Are they on the risk to being closed, too? Where's the end of it? Where in other states, they actually say, hey, we've got underperforming schools. They're in a high-poverty area. Let's put some more resources in it and get these kids up to grade. Why isn't that being considered in Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question and a great critique. When you look at our systems of support and capacity building and resources for high poverty schools, they are woefully neglected in Michigan compared to a state that does that really, really well like Massachusetts. When we look at African American students in Boston by fourth grade being almost 3 years ahead of instruction compared to African American students in Detroit, that tells us that our challenges are not simply just about poverty, right? And that black and brown and poor kids in Michigan can and deserve to be performing and learning at way higher levels. It's we, the adults in the state and the system itself, that are not getting them to that level. So that's where we need to change. We don't want an accountability system that sets up low-performing schools to continue to fail. We want to be fair, right? And so if there is some sort of grading system, right, that says like, okay, you're a D school or you're an F school, the question is not should we be honest with people about how they're performing against their peers, right, compared to other states and in Michigan. The question is, how do we get them to a higher level, right? How do we better support them, better resource them? And we also want to make sure that the grading system is weighing improvement so that they have a chance of getting off that list. You know, if I'm an educator in Flint and I'm at a really low performing school in the state and we do way better work and our improvement like triples that year, right? Don't I deserve to come off that list? And the answer is yes. Like that, we shouldn't be closing schools that are really, really making huge strides for their kids.
So this plan, this proposal that's been put together by the Board of Ed for the Every Student Succeeds Act, there's your brief that is somewhat critical of it. You have concerns. There'll be public input. As I mentioned, the legislature will go through it. By law, the legislature has to go over it. The governor also will look into it. What do you think we're going to have at the end of all that? Because, you know, once we get the public input and it possibly gets politicized, what do we end up with?
I think the MDE has done really, really thoughtful, meaningful work around reimagining an accountability system that is actually much more fair to high poverty schools and working class schools. And it actually is moving away from just focusing on standardized testing. And it's looking at other things like crime and absenteeism, things that we know that research tells us that really make a difference in making kids successful in learning. So that's the good part. I hope that the MDE will keep a lot of that intact. And we hope that the Michigan legislature won't undermine that great work, because it really is going to move us ahead about two decades in terms of the thoughtfulness of these systems. But we also hope that we can really come to an agreement in Michigan that we shouldn't be lowering the performance standards for our kids. I mean, all of the leading states in the country have raised their performance standards for teaching and learning. Why do Michigan students deserve any lower than that?
That is Amber Arellano. She's the executive director of the Education Trust Midwest. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All across Michigan, a number of undocumented Mexican immigrants have been detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials. While President Trump indicated his order would deport criminals, bad hombres, as he put it, there are reports people with only minor violations are being picked up, even people with no apparent violations. Juan Manuel Solana Morales is the Mexican consul in Detroit, and he is with us now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy being here with you.
When you and I talked just after Election Day, you indicated that you were waiting to see if Donald Trump's campaign promises would really become policy. What is your assessment of what's happening now?
Well, basically, I see two different trends. One of the most important trends is that trying to generate an increased level of insecurity among the immigrant population. And I think that basically the efforts that the Mexican Consulate is doing is precisely to change that. It's very important. You cannot be afraid of all the time. So what is important is, first, we understand exactly what kind of action is happening, and we understand, after speaking with immigration authorities here that operate here at the state, that they are focusing in people that have committed some crimes. Second, is very important, you have to be ready to be able to act at any circumstance that happened to you. And third, that you, once you're being ready, you know how to do with your family, your things, in case that you have to move suddenly back to Mexico or any other country. So we are working right now in different aspects regarding to these three issues. The most important one is working together with radio stations like you and other ones to try through media, try to inform the people of their rights, what they can do in front of this. Second, that the Mexican consulate here is ready with a group of lawyers in case that the rights of the people are not respected by authorities. And third, that you start preparing a plan in case that you have to do something that you were not planning to do before. You have a plan, it's a lot easier to deal. And regarding with that, we are working right now with more than 60 different partners around the state to be able to reach out and give away the information that people may need to be able to fulfill these three ideas. First, you don't have to be afraid. Second, you have to be knowing your rights and know how to react to that, knowing that you have support of the Mexican consulate. And third, most important, in case that you have to have new plans in your life, you have to be ready for them.
I'd like us to listen, if we can, to something the president said in his speech last night to the joint session of Congress regarding immigrants.
We will soon begin the construction of a great, great wall along our southern border. As we speak tonight, we are removing gang members, drug dealers, and criminals that threaten our communities and prey on our very innocent citizens. Bad ones are going out as I speak, and as I've promised throughout the campaign.
What did you feel when you heard those words last night?
Well, basically, he's trying to focus on his campaign promises, and let's understand something very important. Every single walk has a door. And as long as we have a structured negotiation between the Mexican government and, of course, the new administration regarding new forms to deal with illegal immigrants, I think there's going to be a plus. Of course, commerce, and that's going to be a plus. And the most important thing is, I can tell you, I'm sure that most of the Mexican immigrants that live here in Michigan are not criminals. So that's why I'm saying they don't have to be afraid. And that's the most important thing you have to understand. Criminals do not help society. Immigrants help society. And we have here a very strong Latino-Mexican population helping the advancement of the society and economy here in Michigan, doing the work that some people don't want to do, paying taxes, helping the society, creating new business. That's exactly the things we have to understand, that mostly all the immigrants we have here in Michigan are helping the society, not going against.
But haven't we seen it where there are people who have either minor violations or none who are being picked up?
In that case, we are trying to advise them to look at understand the rights and ask to see an immigration judge to insist on ways of explaining them on the reason why they're here and work with the rights here. They still have some rights, even their immigrants.
Now, Mexico warned its citizens living in this country to take precautions and remain in contact with consular officials. That supports what you've just told us. I'm wondering what kind of response your consulate in Detroit has seen.
Basically, I see an important increase in the demand for documents and passports, powers of attorney, and registration to by national citizens, and I think that's a positive issue. Second thing, I do not have a huge increase in demands from legal protection yet. But what is important is that we are increasing the relations and the acts and seminars given away by different organizations together with the consulate. So we can educate people what to do, what the rights are, and the most important thing, when they feel that's necessary, as they are detained, as to be see an immigration judge and insist on that, because I think that's part of the rights that they have.
You've set up, your consulate has set up a special hotline for Mexican Americans in Michigan. Yes. Have you been getting more calls?
The increase can be maybe from 8 to 10%, so that's not yet significantly. What I'm seeing is a lot of empty rumors. I'm very worried about that, because that means that people are very scared, and there's a lot of information that may not be true running around. All depends, too, in which areas. I see a lot more rumors in the areas like Grand Rapids. I see less here in Detroit. So it's a social phenomenon, I think, that's happening. But behind it, one start investigating, one start contacting the immigration officials, one start sending my people to jails to see people who have been detained. I see that numbers are not different from the ones that we have in the past administration yet.
During his State of the City address, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan stated that Detroit is a pro-immigration, welcoming city. But he didn't use that term sanctuary city. I'm wondering, how are legal residents and undocumented Mexicans in Detroit feeling about that statement?
Well, I don't know. That's something I cannot answer. We have to ask them.
How about you?
Basically, I think that we have to work with the mayor and see exactly what else we can do together with him to work together to welcome more immigrants and make Detroit better for immigrants.
Now, we've seen, heard more reports of an escalation of attacks on both legal and undocumented immigrants, and even people who just look ethnic, even if they were born here. I'm just wondering, what's being reported among the Mexican and the Mexican-Americans with whom you've had contact?
I don't see any physical attacks. I have seen some change of attitudes in a very small minority. Precisely, that's why we're working close with the local authorities. And I have an incredible good response from them, from sheriffs, from police, from the different mayors in the region, from legislators. So they are all against any kind of bad treatment of people here in the state. So I believe that this relation is going to have to keep these things going on. And so we condemn any kind of action in that regard, of course. We are working, too, to try to reach out and work closer with other immigrants, especially the Arab community, and, of course, the immigrants from India, Pakistan, other countries, because I think it's important that we stand together in this process. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I believe that the mayor of Detroit was talking about when he said that the city is working with immigrants.
Juan Manuel Solano Morales is the Mexican consul in Detroit. And once again, the number for that hotline that at the Mexican consulate is 877-632-6678. Thank you so much for taking our questions today.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.